Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HR Latte, your first cup of talent management whipped to perfection.
Welcome to the show this morning, everyone. This is Rayanne Thorne, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on HR Latte as I continue my series on diversity in the workplace. I've had some great shows. I hope that you will have an opportunity to go back and listen to each of them. We've talked about racial bias, LGBT bias, and we talked about the acronyms that have been added to that group of people, the Q, I, and A. So if you have any questions about those, please visit those. We've talked about ageism. And I hope, you know, China and I talked a little bit before the show a little bit about that, sort of in a roundabout way. We'll hit that too. And also about gender bias, about youth bias. And today we're going to talk about how leadership plays a role in creating a diverse workplace, why it's important for leadership to be involved. And with that, please help me welcome China Gorman. Thank you, China, so much for joining the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Can you please just give us an overview of you and who you are? And it gives our audience a little bit more opportunity to understand why we should listen to you, why what you have to say is important.
That is a question to me as well. Why should anyone listen to me? But so I've spent 30 plus years in the human capital management space, but not as an HR professional, but rather as a business leader. I spent 25 years in the outplacement career development business in growing levels of leadership, ending up as president of Drake B. Morin, one of the originals, and global president of Lee Hecht Harrison. Still probably the leading outplacement career development firm in the world. And then most people know me because I spent 3 years at SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, as the chief operating officer and a stint as the interim CEO. And now more people know me as the CEO of the Great Place to Work Institute, a global research, culture research and analysis company in 50 countries around the world. And most people don't know that in the United States, the research and analysis behind the Fortune 100 Best Companies to Work For list is done by the Great Place to Work Institute. And I was there for almost 2 years and was just telling you this morning, Rayanne, that I recently left the position of global CEO over 50 countries. When I joined a little over 2 years ago, the founder owner was really focused on, you know, turning this little sort of family-owned business around so that, you know, from a financial perspective, as he was passing the 70 mark, he would have some options around ownership and that kind of thing. And I assembled an incredible team. And darned if we didn't get that thing whipped into shape in about 18 months. But my team made it look so easy. And so when the franchise group came to the owner-founder and said, we'd like to buy the global headquarters and leave you with the U.S. franchise, and, you know, they did some negotiating, we turned the business, the global business, the big business, over to them at the end of March. And so a very exciting time and real validation for him and, you know, as well as, you know, a great financial thing for him to be able to give him some options as he and his family, you know, look to other things. But so I'm officially a strategic advisor to the board. But what that really means is I'm starting up my independent consultancy again.
Yeah.
Part analyst.
Oh, good.
Part,
okay.
Part consultant, writer. I still have my blog, chinagorman.com, HR Data Point Tuesday. And I've got a couple of really interesting and terrific long-term projects in the mix that I will probably be able to start talking about in the next couple of weeks. But bottom line, I would love to find another business in the HCM space that's really ready to put the pedal to the metal in terms of growth. So, but I'm going to take my time. As you and I, as I said earlier, and you corrected me, I'm not so young anymore, and so I'm less willing to compromise, and I'm more more focused on, you know, getting the right fit and the right thing.
Well, you and I are both in the same place there. I've actually had the opportunity to turn down jobs, which is nice. When you're in a job search and you know that how important that puzzle piece is in your life, the big picture, you cannot try and fit a piece that won't fit in. As much as you'd like or need or want to work for an organization, if it's not going to fit, it's not going to fit. And I've been lucky enough to really be able to take my time and search for the right position. And I'm sure you're in the same position to really find the right fit. And it's too darn bad that you're just too good at your job because you worked your way out. You did a good job. So that's
it was a magical experience, really. I mean, the mix of an incredible brand that wasn't really well known, but very powerful brand. I mean, who wouldn't want to work?
Well, it is now in our space.
A great place to work, right?
Yeah.
Just genius branding and fabulous people and a mission that is truly noble. I mean, the mission for that organization has always been to really change society by transforming workplaces. And the notion is that every employee in every employer-employee relationship should have the opportunity to work in a great workplace environment. And so who doesn't want to line up behind that? So it was so much fun, and the team did such an incredible, incredible job. And so, I'm prouder. I might be prouder of this experience than some of the other leadership experiences that I've had, although I have to say I've been fortunate. And so this is a segue into our topic, right? I've been fortunate to have around me an incredible, diverse, talented team. And as a business leader, as a CEO, I really believe that the diverseness of experience, thought, and experience that you can, the more diverse of thought, experience, and sort of culture that you can have on your team, the better the output's going to be. I mean, just plain and simple, the better the output is going to be, no matter what the output is. And I've seen it play out time and time again. And diversity, from my perspective, in the top job of a company, is the CEO's business. You're either committed to having a fair, respectful, welcoming culture, and you have to lead it, and you have to show it every day in everything you do, or you're not, and you won't get it. You might have pockets of it because you'll have, you know, maybe the HR leader is committed, and so you'll have a diverse HR team, and maybe, you know, the head of IT is committed, and you'll have, you know, but unless the CEO walks that talk every single day, it's a program. It's not how we do business.
That's right. To say that and express how valuable it is for the CEO to be involved, for the leadership teams to be involved with diversity in the workplace. A couple of weeks ago, I did a presentation on employment branding, and one of the articles that I read as I was preparing said that out of 2,000 CEOs polled, 60% of them said that it was their employment branding was their responsibility.
Yeah.
So I think we're starting to see a shift in the corner office. The corner office is recognizing that they actually have to be more involved in the inner workings of the organization and not just be the final say, but maybe be the first say and then be there to guide, lead, and direct through whatever is going on within that organization. If it's creating a more diverse workforce, so be it. If it's helping to create a better employment brand or instill an employment brand, launch an employment brand, they are recognizing that they need to have more involvement. And who knows, maybe it may be the changing of the guard. It may be younger CEOs coming in and recognizing what didn't work with their former CEOs and how they can have a little bit more responsibility. It'll be interesting to see this shift. So let's
I have a theory about that. I think as it relates to culture, as it relates to people, as it relates to innovation, I think the sea change that we're going to see as the baby boomers leave the corner office, not in dribs and drabs, but, you know, in a wave, like from like 10 years from now, right?
I think
what the corner office turns to HR for is going to be night and day different. Because when you think
So
I'm a baby boomer. I'm right in the middle of my generation. And as I was coming up, as I was having my first general management experiences, HR wasn't HR, it was personnel administration. Not personnel, personnel administration. So it was heavy administration. And what the CEO turned to personnel for was get the paychecks out on time, you know, make sure the vacations are tracked and people are clocking in and clocking out and getting overtime and we're compliant with all the government regulations and that kind of stuff. But there was very little strategy. There was very little people. It was administration. So of course, time, right? But that's how my generation learned what to turn to HR for. And so the folks
who were rules.
Yeah, exactly.
It was all about rules and who was doing what wrong.
Right. And so I think that the folks who are going to go into the CEO office now, that was not their first when they were first general managers, it was HR. And they were business partners. And they may not have, you know, I won't say the furniture words because I just think that's so demeaning. But, you know, they may not have been the most strategic of the business leaders, but still there was strategy. It was about workforce planning. It was about the larger issues of culture and people strategy. And that's what they're going to be looking for from HR as they become CEOs, which changes the HR job, the HR department, the talent, the people management completely. And I hope that HR is ready for that. But I think it's going to be really, really different. And there's going to be a natural expectation around our topic today. There's going to be a natural expectation because the X's and Y's grew up in a much more diverse world than the boomers did. And they went to school with a diverse, you know, elementary. I didn't go to I grew up in the Midwest and, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. I think there were 3 black kids in my elementary school. There were a couple of Jewish kids, and everything else, you know, looked just like me. And that, I don't think that's so much the experience of the X's and Y's. And so it's natural to them. And if they come into an environment that doesn't look like that, I think it's going to be at the top of their agenda to fix.
I would agree. And another great stat that I heard from John Sensor years ago, and I'm sure it's the space between this has gotten even larger since then, was that since 1981, 11 million more women have graduated from college than men.
Yes.
So when you consider, you know, over the last 30 years, how many more women are, and maybe many of them are not in the workplace. They've decided to be stay-at-home moms or whatever they've decided to do with their lives. But if you consider those numbers and how that will impact leadership today and into the next 10 to 20 years, of course there's going to be a shift in female leadership versus male leadership. And so when we think about diversity, it's a huge, huge subject that includes all the different topics that I've talked about in this series. Given the positions that you have held, which bias do you think is the most common in the workplace or the one that is talked about most? Is it racial bias?
I think it depends on where you are geographically. If you're in Silicon Valley right now, it's gender.
Gender, absolutely.
All anybody talks
absolutely.
About, right? If you're in other parts of the country, it's racial. If you're in some places, it's religious bias, right? And it may also have to do with what industry you're in.
Right.
And so, you know, as a leader, I think you can't be overcome by the enormity of the problem, right? So, you know, how do you eat an elephant? You know, one bite at a time.
Right.
And I always think about that. If a leader could just get, you know, consumed with, oh my God, how is this? How can I ever make a difference? And the truth is, just by changing your behavior. I was the leader of a large global company and really focused on the North America business, and we were in a highly competitive business, and it was true that our customers and our potential customers couldn't tell the difference between the three large providers. They just couldn't tell the difference. We sounded the same. We looked the same. In fact, you know, the people, you know, worked for company A for 5 years, and then they worked for company B for 5 years, and then they worked for company C for 2 years. You know, it was a very incestuous business. So we even looked the same. We were the same people. And this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, and there was a high demand for our services. This was the outplacement business, and so we worked one-on-one with lots and lots of people who were losing their jobs. And in this particular down cycle, we were finding more and more gay and lesbian folks who were being terminated, who were out and comfortable saying as they were coming into the outplacement service, you know what, job searches are hard for everybody, but they're really hard for,
right,
you know, for us. I'd really like to work with a consultant who knows what that means from a personal perspective. Who have you got? And I began to hear that, and I also knew I was fairly new as the top leader. I also knew that we had lots and lots of gay and lesbian consultants, but they weren't comfortable to share that with the organization. They would share it with me, but not they, you know, and that was heartbreaking to me. And so as I became the leader of this organization, I made a really clear statement that we needed to be much more diverse. Not only was it the right thing to do, just from a personal morality perspective, but for our business,
right,
it was a critical, critical thing to do. And so
you need to touch everybody, right?
You can't touch everybody if you don't know what everybody is or who everybody is.
Yeah, and for me it was two things. It was, you know, the morality of it, but it was also it was a quality of service issue, right? So
right.
I pumped up our diversity committee. We created more affinity groups. Really, you know, I talked about it all the time. The first general manager opening that I had, I promoted from our bench consultant ranks a fabulous guy who'd worked for us for many years and was so super, and he was a paraplegic in a wheelchair, and no one had ever thought of putting him in a general manager position, and he nailed it. He boomed it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I promoted the first openly gay guy in our business into a general manager role. His career just took off. I think he just retired, and he'd been running like half of the country by that time. I went to my friends outside the business, and frankly in other competitors, and began to recruit other diverse leaders, people that I could hire. I wasn't foisting, you know, diversity on candidates, on other decision makers. These were people that I was hiring. And as the organization began to see that I was hiring people that didn't look like everybody else, there were these aha moments, and bit by bit, after about a couple of years, I became aware that more and more of the folks that I was aware were gay and lesbian were out, and in lower parts of the organization, we clearly had recruited them. So the look of the organization was different, and so many of our employees felt more comfortable, you know, being their whole selves at work every day, which is like such a, if I could give a gift to an organization,
everything.
It would be you when you come to work.
Right.
And I, you know, every wonderful piece of you when you come to work. And we began to win business away from our competitors because we would show up in a shootout and we looked really different, and we were smarter, and we were better, and they saw it, and we began to get feedback that we were winning large accounts because of our commitment to diversity and the follow-through on it. And so, that wasn't a lab experiment, but the results of just walking the talk as the top leader of the organization, day in, day out. I wasn't saying to a general manager, you know, sort of three levels below, you know, I know this terrific Asian gal, you got to hire her.
Right,
but what
right.
I did say to our HR people, I want you to ensure that for every single opening in this company, that in the final slate of candidates, whether that's three or four or however many you have, there has to be a diverse candidate. And by whatever diverse means in your market, because this was a large organization
with
you know, and so for some of our offices, a diverse candidate was a male, to be honest.
Right.
Baby steps, right? One eat that
right.
elephant one bite at a time, and I monitored that and I checked in. So every once in a while, I would call HR and say, okay, we hired that person in Atlanta. I want to see the resumes of the final three candidates, the other two that didn't get the job. And if they couldn't prove to me that it was a diverse slate, we had a really serious conversation about that.
Right. Well, that just shows the value and the importance of leadership stepping in and really mm-hmm. not just talking the talk, but walking the walk and making a difference. We're talking about diversity more. Is it just our mouths moving, or do you think there is a movement? Is there a shift happening?
Oh, well, there's no shift in some organizations, and there's massive shifts in some. The technology industry, headquartered in Silicon Valley, they're talking about it a lot now. They appear to be putting a lot of money behind it. So that's a issue.
Yeah.
That's not enough girls in STEM,
right.
in high school and college. That's gamers are mostly, young males.
Yep.
and young females. It's like, ew, I don't want, it's just, there are. So are we making progress? I think in pockets we are. And I think I think talking about it is good. And I think, one by one, whether, every Ellen Payo wins or loses, it was on the radar for 6 weeks, right?
Right.
Are we treating women differently? Do we have different expectations? Ultimately she didn't prove her case, but boy, we were all in the business world, in the financial world, on the West Coast, we were all talking about that. I think that matters. You don't just wake up one morning like somebody, gave you electric shock therapy and start acting different. You don't go,
right.
if you're a 65-year-old, white male CEO, you don't just like wake up one morning and say, okay, we're going to spend all this money and I'm not going to hire, that just doesn't happen. It's an evolution, and, old dogs can learn new tricks, but,
right.
not with a snap of a finger. And I think it's unrealistic to think things are going to change, in the snap of a finger. But I do think progress is being made. Enough? No, of course not. Of course not.
We're seeing shifts, and that's good. And I hope, you know, while you and I are still hard-working individuals, we're going to see a massive shift over the next 10 years, I believe. So
I think it is going to get faster. I agree.
Yeah. I like most things, once adoption goes, it goes, right? It goes
right.
Quickly.
Yeah.
I talked briefly about this before the show went live. I did not ever in my life wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to have such a hard day because I'm a woman. It's going to be so hard for me to get a job. I never considered that was a disadvantage for me. I always thought, what can I do better than anybody else? And if I can use something about being female, having a softer tone, or, you know, being the confidant to all the younger, you know, the mother figure in an office, mm-hmm. if I can be that, because that naturally comes to me, I'm going to use that to my advantage, right? I'm going to use the skills that I have naturally, not the ones that I've had to work really hard to develop, right? And I never thought that I would come to a place in my life. So that's, some people consider that a bias. I never considered a bias for myself personally. But I've come to a place in my life where a job search, I don't consider the female equation, but it scares me to death that I'm in my 50s and how that will impact how people view me. And so you and I are both in our 50s and find ourselves in a place where, you know, there's a job search going on, or I'm interviewing, or I'm looking. And luckily, I can be very picky. I can select the job that I want. I'm in a place in my life where I'm not desperate for a job. And I understand that you are in the same place. So how does that impact your personal search, or when you talk to clients? Are you concerned about the fact that they may know that you're in your 50s and how they will perceive how you can give back to them, or how you can help the organization?
Yeah. So I'm approaching it the same way I did when I was very young. When I was in my 20s, I told everybody I was 30, just because, you know, what could a kid know, you know? And I was moving into management, and, you know, everybody that I was leading was older than I was, and how the hell is that going to work? I mean, I think it's kind of the reverse. And the way I did that was, I competed hard, and I talked about what I bring and what my successes have been and what my skills are. And the truth is, now that I'm not in my mid-20s, I have a lot more ammo than I had then. Then I was energetic. I was smart. I had some experience. You know, I was 27. I didn't have all that experience, but I did have experience that my peers didn't have, and I think now I have some experience that my peers don't have. I've run a couple of really global businesses. I was in 21 countries working with the business last year. I've turned businesses around. I've grown businesses. You know, everywhere I go, the top line and the bottom line booms. Everywhere I go, diversity increases. Everywhere I go, the results are quantifiable and strong and strong and positive, whether I was there for 7 years or 2 years. And so there is, you know, when you're young and it's all, you know, piss and vinegar, you've got energy and you've got enthusiasm, and, you know, and that's very attractive. When you're older, you know, you may not have as much of that as you used to, although I think I do.
Yes,
but that's not what I'm selling now, right? That's not what you're selling. What we're selling is experience, successful experience, quantifiable results. We can now show, in the hindsight of time, the before and after picture of every place that we've been. And so, you know, when I head out into the market, I don't, like, you know, as you said, I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh my God, I'm over 50, I'm never going to find a job.
Yeah,
I don't even think about my age, except that it's given me experience that makes me a better leader, that makes me a wiser decision maker,
that
makes me a faster decision maker, because I've been through this before. I know the end of that story, and so let's not do that. And then when you couple that, I think, with personal style. I'm not going to say gender-based, but personal style, because there are, I've gotten feedback over the years, you know, that I'm a tougher competitive than many of the males that were counterparts. But I do absolutely have a warm, approachable, authentic side that I think is unique and is what organizations are looking for now. We talked a little bit before the show about trust in the workplace and how critical it is for leaders to be trustworthy, for employees to trust their leaders, not just, you know, when she says something that happens, but trust them that they're competent, trust them that they have a view to the future, trust them that they're going to treat me with respect and have my best interests at heart and not just the owner's best interests at heart. The data that the Great Place to Work Institute has collected over 25 years in more than 50 countries around the world shows really clearly that the foundation of having a really great workplace culture is trust in leadership. And I think that's a little bit in short supply. There are an awful lot
of
workers, employees who may trust their manager, not so sure about, you know, the business leader, not so sure about the CEO. And I can hold that at bay as long as my leader is trustworthy and I can take what my leader says to the bank. But once my leader, you know, makes a commitment or, you know, behaves in a way and doesn't meet the commitment or behaves in a way that is truly, you know, not my values, and I don't trust the top leadership of the organization, my resume's out there, I'm looking, and I'll be gone soon. And we certainly, you know, the quit statistics from the Department of Labor are rising every month, and so as the economy gets stronger and stronger, paying attention to these cultural values of respect for employees, which means all employees, regardless of age, regardless of gender or sexual orientation or religious background or national or cultural background, respecting all employees, treating them equitably, paying them fairly, that includes both genders, that becomes more and more important if you want to hang on to your people, because the economy's improving and they've got options. The good ones, the ones you want to keep, the ones you're building your business plan on. They've got more options, and they will have more options tomorrow than they have today. And so it's these cultural values that include diversity but are at the heart of it, wrapped around trust and respect, I think are the critical cultural values that leaders are really starting to pay attention to. And it's hard if you haven't. It's really hard if you haven't been paying attention to those.
Trust like respect is a two-way street. It only works really well if both sides participate, and it has to be given in order to be received. The show I knew would go way too fast, Chyna. So we've got to wrap it up.
Are we there already? Oh my God,
we're there already. I know. I don't know how this happens every time, but I love the format where we get to really dive into a topic quickly and deeply as quickly as possible. So, when you consider your own future, so you have clients, you have projects that are underway now. So
yeah,
when you consider your own future as a provider of services, as a trusted leader, what are some key things that you do or that you implement in order to do your job more effectively, more efficiently?
So I think particularly in the volatile times where we are today, the trust issue is big. It was no secret. I was the 8th CEO in 9 years at Great Place to Work. And what my colleagues wanted more than anything else was to trust the leader and to think that the leader, you know, was going to be there for a while. And so creating personal relationships, that's why I was in 21 countries last year, creating personal relationships where we can look each other in the eye, where I can see them and know their name, and we can have personal conversations to build that trust, to build that two-way respect, I think is critical. Now, if you're, you know, if you're Jeff Immelt, you can't have those conversations with every single employee, but you can have those conversations with your top 200 leaders or your top 300 leaders. It's a matter of scale. If you're the CEO of a company that's got 900 employees, you can know all the business leaders, absolutely, and you can know all the people, you know, in your country, absolutely, and you should, and you must. More the employer-employee relationship, I think, is getting more and more personal. Just as we're appreciating more diversity. Well, how can you appreciate diversity unless you know people, right?
That's right.
So I think this requirement for leaders to be trustworthy and respectful is also wrapped around being authentic and approachable and easy to connect with. And so when I head into a new assignment, I walk the halls memorizing faces and names, and at the end of the day walk around and give myself a quiz, you know, Amy, Sheila, Lori, Tony, you know, as I walk around. That makes a huge impact. A leader wants to really remember our names. Are you kidding? So that then when you start the hard work of strategy or operational changes or infrastructure changes, you've got a relationship. You can rally the troops, even if it's through, you know, video and long distance, because you've spent the time creating relationships. And if it's a huge company, you can't know everybody, but you can know all your senior leaders, and those folks can know all their people, and the people below them can know. You know what I mean? One of the things that I think is changing, even though we're moving more and more to automation and robotics and technology and, you know, people working from home, all of these things, I think, make it even more important for the human relationships at work. Because if you're working from home, you know, you don't have the personal connection. Technology's great. We've got Skype. We've got, you know, WebEx. We've got all of these great things. But there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that replaces breathing the same air, looking each other in the eye live, and having a conversation. And so creating those kinds of relationships is only going to get harder. It's not going to get easier because of technology, and robotics will be less and less, you know, personal with each other. And, leadership is personal. And particularly in our space, particularly in the human capital management space, we are all about people. And we have to manage our businesses as if we're all about people, whether it's we're selling a technology solution or a technology-enabled service or a service or a product. The personal side of leadership, being trustworthy, being approachable, being honest and respectful, I think is getting more and more important in ways that it never has been before.
Wow, China, so much great stuff in what you've said, so many wonderful nuggets, and I hope that our listeners were able to grasp a few of them and can implement them into their lives, either as leaders, leadership development, moving forward in their own careers. We've come to the end of the show, but I always throw in my quick hit faves, and this is my favorite part of the show because I get to ask my guests some of their favorite things, which I often learn new things about the guests and also new places to go, new foods to try. So we'll hit this real quick, and then we'll say goodbye, and thank you so much for joining us today. What is your favorite food?
So I'm a breakfast girl, and my favorite my favorite breakfast is at Sarah Beth's in New York City, the lemon ricotta pancakes. That's it.
Man, those sound fantastic. I'm definitely going to try that the next time I'm there. Your favorite book. Now, this could be a book, favorite book of all time, could be something that you're reading right now that you'd like to share.
Well, actually, this is a shameless promotion. There's a new book out called The Other F Word, How Smart Leaders, Teams, and Entrepreneurs Put Failure to Work, by my friends John Danner and Mark Coopersmith. And it's a great book published by Wiley. It's a great book. You should read it. And I wrote the afterwards. So
Oh, good.
So I'm sort of in the mode of this is a really good book and learning from failure, particularly as it relates to culture. And so how do you make failure okay in your culture is a great question.
Wow,
and they've done some really, really good work. Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Exactly.
I will definitely get that's on my list now for sure. See, this is why I ask these questions. And your favorite place in the world. I know you have traveled everywhere. And so this could be a remote location. It could be just being at home. Maybe you like being home because you're gone
so
much. But
yeah, I do actually like being at home. But I have told my husband of 34 years next week that if we ever have that big fight and I leave and he wants to find me, I'm going to be in Positano, Italy.
Oh, that my friend Mira is leaving from there today. She's at her sister's wedding in Italy, and she just posted pictures of Positano. It looks beautiful.
Positano is just beautiful. It is. It's lovely.
I'm hoping
it's just lovely.
Next January, we're talking about a trip to Italy, and we'll definitely,
make
it there.
Oh, you got to do it. The Amalfi Coast is fabulous.
Now I definitely have to do it. So, and last but not least, what is your favorite thing to do?
Live theater. The West End in London,
what?
Broadway in New York, the high school down the road, live theater.
Oh.
I'm just the creativity of man to put together, and especially musicals. So to put together drama and music and dance and scenery and costume and put it all together, you know, I just I'm in awe of that, and there's no such thing as bad live theater in my view.
I am in agreement with you because of the bravery. The bravery
and the teamwork. Coming together these days of technology, and it's amazing to me. It's amazing.
Oh, well, we need to spend more time together because that is one of my favorite things to do, too. China, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for contributing
welcome.
To this very valuable series. The topic, diversity in the workplace, has meant a great deal to me, and I've had so many wonderful guests. I hope that listeners will go back and listen to other shows. I'm going to be wrapping the series up on Thursday with Torin Ellis, who was my very first guest, and we're going to talk about all the different types of biases that we discussed. And I'm sure she'll have a lot to say about your words today, China. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. It's always great to talk with you, Rayanne.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you on Thursday back here on HR Latte as we wrap up the series, Diversity in the Workplace.